And there's one big tree in there, one there called Shrimp. But there's also another one there called Spear. And these trees blossom and they bear fruit and they drop in the ground. One of these seeds was called 9/11. And from this seed grew a tree called the War on Terror. From this War on Terror, we've had Afghanistan, Iraq, the emergence of civil liberties, human rights, the peace of Indonesia. And why it goes so quick? Because the earth is rich and fertile in human history. So what we're going to ask you today, so this is a very serious issue, and what we're going to postulate has very serious implications for each and every one of us. Now, I know that just all of you have beliefs, right? Everyone has something to believe in. And we're going to ask you not to discard those beliefs. Whether you believe or not believe, we're just asking you not to discard it. What we're going to ask you to do is actually look at things this film is made with just common sense and your wisdom, and a bit of humanity. Okay? The fact is, the 9/11 truth movement is a movement that was born out of the victims of the New York attack. Last the 9/11 Commission report felt that the answers to their questions had been answered, didn't have been answered at all. And they felt that they need to have a definitive report about their loved one's death. What Truth Digital is about, we just started this thing out, which is about 3 months old, and we've come together to just write this, do this film. And we've taken this film from other people who've made high energy in this field, who've made reports about this. And we've taken reports from everywhere on the internet, on the news, and everything else. We'd just like to say thanks to all the people that's come along, David and Alan Schrader, the Cube Cinema, all those guys that we've taken the films from, and everybody at Chief Pistol. And I just hope that afterwards we can hopefully be able to empower everybody else who's in here to go and conduct your own research about this. Do not believe anything I have to say. You need to go and find out for yourself. I hope this just inspires you to do just that. Okay?
Can you say why it's important that we do that? Why is it important?
Because there's a lot of information that you obviously need to use your common sense and wisdom to find out if it's the right information, if it is the truth, if it is indeed fact. And that's what we're trying to do. This part of this film is close to that. Okay? Cheers. And another good thank you for all you guys for coming. We didn't expect so many of you to come back to them, really.
to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves, away from the guilty.
On September 11th, 2001, four planes crashed within an hour and 15 minutes of one another.
Do we want to think about the scrambling aircraft?
God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower.
Ring, 3 rings from the impact. For that hole to have been caused by Flight 77, that Boeing would have had to smash through 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete. Upon further inspection, we found that the damage at the Pentagon was completely and totally inconsistent with the damage of the planes that had hit the World Trade Center. I mean, after all, the planes that hit the Trade Center created a fire so intense that it fatigued the steel and collapsed the building, or so that's what we were told. And yet, when you look at the left side of the Pentagon, you'll note that there is very little, if any, smoke damage or heat damage at all. On the third floor, it's very plain to see a file cabinet with a computer monitor. Neither of them are damaged. On the second floor, you can see a wooden desk. It hasn't burned. And on the first floor, a very curious sight indeed, a wooden stool with a book that is laying and open. The pages aren't even singed. Only a few scraps were found, such as this thin piece. Only one engine was found, and it was small. A Boeing 757 has two engines about 9 feet in diameter. How could such a large airplane with such large engines leave behind only a few small scraps? Surveillance cameras from a nearby gas station at Sheraton Hotel would capture the entire thing. Why was the FBI there within minutes to confiscate the tapes, including a warning for the employees not to discover they had seen? If the government wishes to prove once and for all that Flight 7 attempts at the Pentagon, all they would have to do is release one of those tapes. Instead, they released five prints from a camera across the heliport, even though none of them show a Boeing 757. How did Flight 77 get to the Pentagon? This is another suspicious aspect of the attack. The plane vanished from air traffic controllers near Ohio, as shown by the question mark. Air traffic controllers immediately called for help. Less than an hour later, an unidentified blip appears on the radar screen near the Pentagon. Supposedly, Flight 77 traveled all the way from Ohio to the Pentagon without any of the air traffic controllers noticing its blip on the radar screen, even though they were looking for it. The Air Force did not notice this plane either, even though the Pentagon is off limits to aircraft. If an aircraft as large as a 757 can travel hundreds of miles through American airspace without anybody noticing, what good is our air defense system and our air traffic control system? And consider that three other airplanes were also wandering around. Then consider that the planes entered restricted airspace. After they realized that Flight 77 disappeared, they should have been able to locate it with their radar. They had nearly an hour to find it. It should also have shown up on Air Force radar. Furthermore, how could the terrorists find the World Trade Center and the Pentagon without assistance from the air traffic controllers? This is the cockpit of a 757. How would they know where to fly? Would they use a compass and a map? How would they see below the clouds?
Going into town, and I heard this plane come over my head. It was really small. It sounded like a small plane. I mean, it was like a cruise missile with wings, went right there and slammed right into the Pentagon. Huge explosion, a great ball of fire, and smoke started billowing out. Is disturbed or destroyed in one area, within reason, it should be able to, the structure should be able to transfer the load from that point and carry it down to the foundation using a different path.
This photo shows both a rectangular core column and some square exterior columns. There were 236 of these square columns running up the exterior of each tower. Every floor was a mesh of steel trusses. There were two sets of trusses crisscrossing each other to form a rectangular grid. Corrugated steel pans were attached to the top of the trusses. Concrete was poured into these pans to form strong, flat, and fireproof floors. The exterior columns were spaced every meter along the outside of the towers. Windows were placed between the columns. The exterior columns were further strengthened with steel plates. The plates were welded to the columns and then bolted to one another. This grid of trusses was repeated every 12 feet. It is important to realize that the framework of these towers were 100% steel. This is a highly simplified cross-section of the tower. There were 47 rectangular columns in the center of the tower. There were 236 exterior columns. These exterior columns were literally on the outside of the building. According to the engineering sites that have technical data for these towers, the wind force that these towers had to withstand was greater than the force of those airplanes. Is jet fuel capable of creating some type of monster fire that destroys steel buildings?
To the impact, the North Tower stood for more than an hour, long enough for hundreds, perhaps thousands, to escape. The collapse, when it came, was caused by fire.
The maximum temperature hydrocarbons can reach in the atmosphere is about 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. However, that maximum temperature can be reached only when the hydrocarbons and the air are mixed in perfect proportions, such as a kitchen stove. Even though stoves reach the maximum possible temperature, they never shatter into pieces. So how could even lower temperatures cause the towers to disintegrate? Even if the fires were intense, fire does not shatter steel structures. The 32-story building in Madrid, Spain, is a good example. The fire became so intense that it spread from one floor to the next. This fire was much larger than the fire at the World Trade Center. However, the building remained standing, and it continued to support a large construction crane at the top. The issue of the World Trade Center's collapse is at the crux of the story of September 11th. Kevin Ryan, an employee at Underwriters Laboratories, the company that certified the steel components that were used in the World Trade Center, sent a letter to Frank Gale of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, arguing that the steel used in the World Trade Center met all the standards for resistance against a fire. We know that the steel components were certified to ASTM E11-9. The time temperature curves from this standard require the samples to be exposed to temperatures around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for several hours. I think we can all agree that even unfireproof steel will not melt until reaching red-hot temperatures of nearly 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The contention that this steel did fall at temperatures around 250 degrees Celsius suggests the majority of deaths on September 11th were due to a safety-related feature. That suggestion should be a great concern to my company. Days after writing this letter, Kevin Ryan was fired from his position. We were told that the collapse began when one floor broke and the pieces fell to the floor below it. Those pieces shattered that floor, and so on, all the way down. However, when the pieces hit the floor below, they will slow down slightly. Therefore, there should be a delay every time the pieces hit a floor. According to the scientists who analyzed the seismic data, the North Tower collapsed in about 8 seconds. The collapse started at about the 94th floor, near this woman. This means that 94 floors shattered at an average rate of about 10 floors per second. If this woman had tossed the steel beam off the edge, it would have hit the ground about 8 seconds later. The formula to figure this out is very simple, if we ignore air resistance. 94 floors at 12 feet per floor is 1,128 feet. Divide that by 16 and take the square root, and we get 8.4 seconds. This means that the North Tower collapsed as fast as objects fall when there is no air resistance. How can steel skyscrapers disintegrate so rapidly?
Out of the tower. Now this was, again, this is tape, and you can see now whether that was an explosion or exactly what happened that caused that second tower to collapse. We cannot tell you.
Do you still think that jet fuel brought down the World Trade Center? In all the videos of the collapses, explosions can be seen bursting from the buildings 20 to 30 stories below the demolition wave. Here. Thank you.
chances are it was filming her documentary, WTC, the first 24 hours, and caught both collapses on tape. Watch carefully. The tripod shakes exactly 9 seconds before the tower begins collapsing, and a small piece of debris is knocked off the right-hand side of the building. Not to mention this video of the second impact. An explosion is clearly seen bursting from the building more than 50 feet from the crash.
Explosion of the building. If you've seen many of the managed demolitions where they implode the building and they cause it essentially to fall vertically, you know, they cause all of the vertical columns to fail simultaneously. That's exactly what it looks like, and that's what happened.
It was live on television. I mean, it's literally millions of people.
And tribal made it about a block. We made it at least 2 blocks, and we saw it in the live. All my sports are popping out.
Sure they're going to be able to contain the fire. You know, we have such terrible loss of life. It was
This is a photo taken 1 second into Building 7's collapse. Notice the crown. When we look at other controlled demolitions, we see that they first blow one of the central columns so the building falls in on itself. If you don't do this, the building falls outward and has a wider collapse radius and can damage surrounding structures. Seconds after 7 collapsed, this is what Dan Rather had to say about it.
The Trade Center Building 7's collapse. Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself. Now go to videotape the collapse of the building.
Defense Command is charged with defending North America's airspace. On the morning of September 11, 2001, Vice President Dick Cheney was in control of NORAD. This was the first time in U.S. history that a president or vice president was in direct control of a military agency. NORAD was founded in 1957, and generals always had the power to shoot down or intercept hijacked aircraft. But on June 1, 2001, just 3 months before 9/11, Dick Cheney ordered Donald Rumsfeld to allow him to take control of NORAD itself and the shoot-down procedure, and remove that power from the generals so they could do nothing. Here is a copy of the memorandum from Rumsfeld to the Joint Chiefs, telling them they no longer have any authority.
We're going to take a closer look tonight at another example of where, despite the conventional wisdom, there were people in the United States who actually were preparing to defend against the kind of attacks which occurred here on 9/11. The North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD for short, has been defending the skies over the U.S. and Canada for almost 50 years, 46 to be precise. USA Today reports that in the 2 years before the attacks on September the 11th, NORAD conducted exercises using hijacked airliners as weapons. And one target was the World Trade Center.
They nearly hated us. But there was nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government could envision flying airplanes into buildings on such a massive scale.
That turns out not to be true. U.S. military planners did envision and practice those very scenarios. As reported by USA Today, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, conducted exercises with fighter jets, simulating hijacked planes flown into the World Trade Center.
Throughout the northeastern United States are many air bases. But that morning, no interceptors respond in a timely fashion to the highest alert situation. This includes the Andrews squadrons, which have the longest meantime and are 12 miles from the White House.
In the case of American Airlines Flight 77, which departed Dulles and was crashed into the Pentagon, the FAA lost contact at 8:50 a.m. However, fighters were not scrambled until 9:24 a.m., a delay of over 30 minutes.
Now, Andrews Air Force Base is a huge installation. It's home to Air Force One, the President's plane. It's home base for two combat-ready squadrons of jet interceptors, mandated to ensure the safety of the U.S. Capitol. Andrews is only 12 miles from the White House. On September 11th, the squadrons there are the 121st Fighter Squadron of the 113th Fighter Wing, equipped with F-16s, and the 321st Marine Fighter Attack Squadron of the 49th Marine Air Group, Detachment A, equipped with F-A-18s. This information was on the website of the base on September 11th. On September 12th, Andrews chose to update its website. I find it odd that after the update, there's no mention of the F-16 and F-18 fighters. The base becomes, according to the website, home to a transport squadron only. Yet at 6:30 in the evening of September 11th, NBC Nightly News, along with many outlets, reported, it was after the attack on the Pentagon that the Air Force then decided to scramble F-16s out of the D.C. National Guard Andrews Air Force Base to fly a protective cover over Washington, D.C. What is the reason for the failure of U.S. military jets to show up in a timely fashion on 9/11?
Well, the simple fact is, Jerry, they didn't know where to go. The reason that they didn't know where to go was because a number of conflicting and overlapping war game exercises were taking place. One, with only 8 available fighter aircraft, and they had to be dispatched in pairs, they were dealing with as many as 22 possible hijacks on the day of 9/11, and they couldn't separate the war game exercises from the actual hijacks. Is this real world or exercise?
Now, the commission imagines, page 35, that at 8:46, when Flight 11 hits the North Tower of the World Trade Center, neither the President or anyone, quote, in the White House or traveling with the President knew that Flight 11 had been hijacked at 8:14 that morning. wrong. The commission imagines, page 39, that as late as 9:30, quote, no one in the president's traveling party had any information that other aircraft were hijacked or missing. Wrong. The commission imagines it can get away with such claims, even though millions of people saw TV news reports about the hijackings on CNN beginning at 8:48. The 9/11 Commission published their report in July 2004. On the front cover, the report describes itself as the final report of the Commission. But many people complain that this final report is still not answering some of the important questions. One of those people is Senator Mark Dayton of Minnesota.
And the Commission testimony 20 months later covered up those truths. They lied to the American people, they lied to Congress, and they lied to your 9/11 Commission. NORAD issued an official chronology which stated that the FAA notified NORAD of the second hijacking at 8:43. Wrong. FAA notified NORAD of the third hijacking at 9:24. We're going to hear a wrong. FAA notified NORAD of the fourth hijacking at an unspecified time, and that prior to the crash in Pennsylvania, Langley F-16 combat air patrol planes were in place, remaining in place to protect Washington, D.C. All untrue.
The cover-up is as important as the crime.
There are, of course, two basic theories of 9/11. Both of them are conspiracy theories. One of them is the official conspiracy theory put out by the Bush administration, according to which the attacks were planned and carried out entirely by Al-Qaeda, inspired by Osama bin Laden. The other account, which is the alternative conspiracy theory, suggests that the attacks were made possible by the complicity of the Bush administration itself. But it is definitely not impartial as between these two theories. The commission began its work simply by assuming the truth of the official theory. And it uses this theory to decide which events are relevant. If the official story is true, the White House surely must be highly motivated to turn heaven and earth to investigate the events of that day as quickly and thoroughly as possible. That's how it's usually done. 6 days after the sinking of the Titanic, a chairman is appointed to head an investigation. 9 days after Pearl Harbor, the first of four investigative commissions is struck. The JFK assassination, the Challenger disaster, 7 days each. How many days after 9/11 is it that President Bush named someone to head an investigation?
This commission has been charged with a crucial task.
Call it foot dragging. Budget. In January 2003, the Bush administration allots the commission $3 million. This compares to $5 million for a 1996 commission that looked into casino gambling, and $50 million each for the inquiries into the Columbia shuttle explosion and the Clintons' failed Whitewater deal. The dollar amount is later grudgingly raised, but never exceeds $15 million. We're also told in the preface that they intended their work to be independent and nonpartisan. The White House chooses all the commissioners. Lynn calls them key insiders rife with conflicts of interest. The White House brazenly appoints as the executive director one Dr. Philip Zelikow, a right-wing Republican hawk deeply involved in the Bush circle, a member of the Bush-Cheney transition team, and a National Security Council advisor with Condoleezza Rice under Bush 1. Now, why is this important? As director of the staff, he decided which lines of inquiry were worthy to be looked into, which subjects should be subject to research, and which ones should not. Therefore, as executive director, Zelikow could
direct the staff to investigate those events that were relevant to the official conspiracy theory and simply ignore all events that would be supportive of the alternative conspiracy theory.
It's important to understand that the man who, according to the FBI, is considered to be the so-called money man behind the 9/11 terrorists, I'm talking about the head of Pakistan's military intelligence, Mohammed Ahmad.
In the aftermath of 9/11, the FBI confirmed that General Ahmed, then head of Pakistan's ISI, had authorized a $100,000 wire transfer to Mohammed Atta, the alleged ringleader of the terrorist hijackers.
Well, this same individual was on an official visit to Washington from the 4th to the 13th of September, and he met Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, George Tenet, his counterpart. Now, the question you have to ask yourself is, the money man behind 9/11 is in Washington meeting top officials, and at the same time sending money to the terrorists. Doesn't this sound, what is the proximity group of this individual from the sociological point of view? Okay? He is linked for the terrorists, he is linked for the Bush administration. He's buddy-buddy with George Tenet, he's buddy-buddy with Mohammed Atta. Does that not suggest that senior Bush officials should at least give us the answers of what they were doing with this guy?
In the three business days before the September 11th attack, some wealthy investors made suspicious investments in which they were betting that the price of United and American Airlines stock would drop in value. After the attack, they made millions of dollars profit. Many people assumed that those investors knew the attack was going to occur and that they decided to take advantage of it. Who were those investors? Within days, government agencies in the United States and other nations began an international investigation to determine who those people were and whether they knew the attack was coming. That international investigation has been going on and we're still waiting for their conclusion. Doesn't this imply that somebody stopped every one of those investigations? How could terrorists have the ability to stop such important investigations, and in several different countries?
The population doesn't know this because people like the Western media in Canada and the United States don't tell them.
So what about the hijackers? It's the funniest thing, but at least nine of them are still alive. Waleed Al-Sheri is a Saudi Airlines pilot in Casablanca, Morocco. Wailan Al-Sheri is alive and well. Abdulaziz Al-Amari is a Saudi Airlines pilot living in Saudi Arabia. Mohand Al-Sheri is alive in Saudi Arabia. Khalid Al-Madar is a computer programmer in Mecca. Salam Al-Hamdi works at a chemical plant in Yanbu, Saudi Arabia. Saeed Al-Ghamdi is trained to be a pilot in Tunis. Ahmed Al-Nami is an administrative supervisor for Saudi Airlines. And last but not least, Mohammed Atta's father claimed to receive a phone call from his son on September 12th.
By the CIA to be an intelligence asset. And intelligence assets are controlled by their sponsors. That does not, of course, mean that Al-Qaeda is necessarily pro-American. It means that Al-Qaeda is being used to perform certain functions for the U.S. Intelligence apparatus. And it goes to a whole complex group of intermediaries.
If they do it, it's terrorism. If we do it, it's counterterrorism. That's a historical universal.
The FBI has gone public, as well as the CIA. They even leaked the orders, like W199I, where George Bush ordered them to back off Osama bin Laden and his family. In fact, they even fired some agents that refused to follow their orders. There were red flags everywhere. Everyone knew that the attack was coming. That's why so many public officials didn't go to New York. But months before, there was the Bush administration frustrating the investigations, ordering the agents off the cases, ensuring that the attacks would go forward. Then there were the media reports by respected institutions backed up by hospital officials at the American hospital in Dubai, Pakistan, of Osama bin Laden meeting with the CIA Middle East section chief for 10 days in July of 2001, months before September 11. The question is, what was the CIA doing meeting with Osama bin Laden?
Palestine recently seemed to muse aloud whether you had advanced knowledge of 9/11. Do you agree or disagree with the RNC that this kind of rhetoric borders on political hate speech?
Yeah. They're sacro politics. And, you know, sacro politics. And, some certain simulation.
We don't want the facts to be known. And for very good reasons. But if people know the facts, they're not going to tolerate them. So they have to prevent them from knowing. You have to indoctrinate them. You have to tell them stories.
What justification do we have for bombing Afghanistan? Oh, that's right. The bin Laden confession tape. On December 14th, 2001, the government released a tape allegedly of bin Laden confessing to the attack of September 11th, which they claimed to find in a house in Kandahar, Afghanistan. Except there's a number of things wrong with this tape. One, the tape itself is of very poor quality. And two, the man in the video looks and acts nothing like bin Laden. According to the FBI's website, Osama is left-handed. Yet, in this video, he's writing a note with his right hand. Not to mention, he's wearing a gold ring and watch, which is forbidden by Islamic law, and is also never mentioned in the FBI's description of him. Compare this video to four other pictures of bin Laden. Does anybody else see a problem here? Until the government can prove without a shadow of a doubt that Al-Qaeda was behind September 11th, the American people have every reason to believe otherwise.
Thank you.
Did you find anything on the tape? Because they're all over the world. We've got these contributions on to make this. We've got to meet them very quickly because there is another 100 people out there. And I just think that these two people see me. One of them say, if they want to come up, they need to be able to see me. They set a dollar. Okay, everyone is going to follow David up the courtyard, and Donna, our events manager here, is going to explain how you do it.
Because we've got another 100 or so people out there, and we don't want a collision with you lot and the people out there, so what we need to do is if you people in here can go out this door and go round to the courtyard and follow us to the courtyard where David is. And then what I have to do, and some of us will have to do, is the people in the courtyard, we have to bring them round so that they can come in this way, so it's all one way, so that there's not a collision between the two of you.
You understand that?
Yeah. Come out here, that door, left.
Thank you,
and don't injure yourself.
If you need more information,